Welcome to today's Talkie Bit. Where to begin? Well, maybe where I often begin. Breathing. Let's keep breathing. I also had occasion this past week to photograph a bunch of people, a whole batch of portraits, which doesn't happen that often these days for me as a working photographer, but that was the occasion this week. And I found myself having to frequently remind people, once they're sort of all settled in place, to keep breathing. When we feel like we have to be a certain way at a certain time, one of the things that gets fiddled with right away is our breath. We start to hold it. We stop breathing as an autonomic function. We become conscious of our breath in a negative way. What I want us to do together this morning is be attentive to our breath in a positive way. And when I say I want us to, that's my desire for all of us to share. It is not a mandate for all of us to share. Just thought I'd recycle the word mandate just for fun. And it's an invitation. And not even a strong recommendation. If this bag is for you, pick it up. If this bag is not for you, put it down. Don't pick it up. Go get your coffee. Pray. Read something. Spend these moments doing what centers you. But that's the idea, is that it's an opportunity for us to be still, or stiller, and calm, and to center ourselves together, and go on from there. So I'll guide us through this, if you're joining us, and then we'll carry on from there. I'd like you to close your eyes, or if there is a spot in front of you that is still, so, you know, not Rosa, or one of the kids, focus on that. All right, so still spot, or close your eyes, and then just to turn your attention inward to your breath. Invite you to breathe deeply, slowly, and evenly from your diaphragm. Breathe so your stomach rises and falls while you breathe, and your chest moves only a little. And if you want, you can place your hand on your chest and on your abdomen to kind of be attentive to this, right? So slowly, evenly, from your diaphragm, okay? Invite you to pay attention to your breathing as you inhale and as you exhale. And if your attention drifts elsewhere, as it certainly may, don't judge your thoughts. Just notice them and then bring your attention back to your breath. I invite you to be mindful of the sensations that are caused by that slow, rhythmic breathing. Pay attention to the air that's flowing in and out of your body. Be aware of your abdomen rising and falling. Listen to the sound of your breath. When your mind wanders, just acknowledge it. Come back to your breath. All right. I invite you to open your eyes if they were closed, or to move your focus off the object that you were focused on and be back here. Peace, everybody. I am so grateful to be able to share moments like that with this community. I'm grateful we get to do it this way. I look forward very much to doing it in person. When we met last week at Justin's, it's a small group of us there. It was so good to be in the room with some of you. And more to come. All being weller as we go. So we can look forward to that. All right, let's get into it. Have you ever really thought about that saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater? because it's horrid. I mean, honestly, who would do that? Okay, I know it's an idiom. I shouldn't take it so literally, but if you could excuse me for a few moments, I intend to do exactly that. Because I think there is something to possibly be gained by that exercise. So, in the first place, I suspect that most of us have never either had or at least given a baby bath in a way that meant that the bath water would afterward be thrown out. This is a pre-indoor plumbing image. I mean, we discard after bath water, of course, but generally we discard it down the drain, not tossed out the window or out the back door. And I honestly can't decide whether the, you know, adjusted for modern plumbing version is more cruel or less cruel, because it would be something like, don't let the baby go down the drain with the bathwater, which is also quite awful and even less plausible than the original. So when I was thinking about this saying, one of the things I did is I was like, are there other ways to, you know, what are some other images that could accomplish this same sort of idea? And it's not that hard to find parallel sayings for this one. Don't throw the shovel out with the snow. That felt a little bit timely to me, especially at this moment when I'm basically ready to throw in the towel when it comes to throwing out the snow. My personal favorite from that little piece of research that I did was, don't throw the champagne out with the cork. Yep, good advice. I mean, sometimes we need to throw the champagne out, but you get it, right? You know, the good stuff, the not good stuff. But none of those have quite the idiomatic heft of the one involving the baby. At least not for me. The original, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, has apparently been around since 1512. As far as we can tell from the evidence we have, it's when it first showed up in a German novel. And it showed up along with a woodcut, a drawing essentially, that showed a seemingly indifferent looking woman vigorously emptying a wooden washtub, including the baby that had been bathed in it. So this woman is pouring out this large wooden tub, and the water's flowing out in this unlikely concentrated form, and the baby is flowing out head first, bottom up, head down into the ditch or wherever the water's going with it. That's what the woodcut shows. Well, I would have thought that the saying was self-explanatory until I heard a British comedian attempt to explain it. His take on it was that it was an English saying. Somehow a little colonial moment was like, actually, I think we had it, and we took it to the world. Anyway, so his take on it was that it was an English saying. It was from the coal mining era, and that the key to understanding the saying was to remember that because water had to be hauled by hand and heated on a wood stove, it's a laborious process, because it was so laborious, many people would bathe in the same water. Ick, I think. But wait, it gets worse. So in his version of understanding this story, the dad, who is a coal miner, comes home at the end of the day and he's covered in coal dust. And his wife, true to the gendered norms of the era and the culture, has been home taking care of the baby in the household all day. And she says, listen, you're a mess, but I've heated water and I've filled up the tub. So why don't you go have a nice warm bath while I stay here by this hot wood stove and get us all some supper, which he does. And then the woman of the house, who is also feeling a bit sweaty and grimy from the labors of her day, has a bath as well. And then the baby, who's been crawling around on the dirt floor all day, gets the last pass, by which point the water is so filthy that when they go to dump it out, they can't even see that the baby is in there, so the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater. See how possible that is, right? In any case, the point, of course, is that we should be careful not to throw the good out along with the bad. In a slightly different spin, that same saying is sometimes taken to mean that we should be careful to not discard the essentials while retaining the superfluous, because we're just being so zealous about our cleaning up. And that really isn't that hard to find examples of these days, is it? In an age that seems to specialize in what I might call judge and discard, with the discarding often being accompanied by overzealous and unnuanced rhetoric, perhaps that's the cautionary note that this idiom should sound for us. The fact that the two key elements of the original saying are what they are, baby and bathwater, can be instructive. The first, water, is essential to our staying alive. It's one of the core elements. It's one we can't go very long without. Earth, Wind, and Fire, I learned recently, originally had water in their name as well. It's a little clunky, isn't it? Earth, Wind, Fire, and Water. Anyway, it's in that list, right? It's essential. But everything that I just said in the last few moments about this idiom measures the value of water against a higher value. So as important as water is, what makes the saying work is that there's a higher value, and that is the value of human beings. And the reason that saying might get us in the gut if we stop and think about it is because as important as water is, it is of relatively lesser consequence when weighed against the value of a human life. And that seems like it's never clearer, at least emotionally, than when the life in question is that of a child. Choosing between the baby and the bathwater shouldn't be that difficult, should it? But sometimes it seems like we forget that, or at least we lose sight of it. And when that happens, sometimes we need the poets to bring the balance back into view. In November of 1985, so this is at the height of the Cold War, America and Russia are making the whole world nervous because they're stockpiling nuclear weapons, and there just is this ceaseless saber-rattling rhetoric going back and forth. At that time, the artist Sting was making the move from being the front man of the Police to starting his solo career. I was a fan of the Police. You know, when I think back on it, other than hearing a grade school classmate play a Beatles record that he had plundered from an older sibling's collection, which is a single. Do I have to explain single? The actual thing? Anyway, a 45 RPM single, one side of which was, I think, She Loves Me, Yeah, 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 and the other side was Hard Day's Night. She Loves Me, Yeah, 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 little music trivia moment for you because I think it's funny. Apparently one of the songwriters, one of the Beatles' dads, objected to the use of that American colloquialism, Yeah, 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 in the lyric. He suggested that it would be more proper if it was Yes, 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 which She Loves Me, Yes, 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 is a very different song, is it not? Anyway, other than that single, some of the music that I remember most from my younger years is the Police album Synchronicity. I had never heard anything like the music that these folks were making. And when I hear something that feels like it came from a new place, that gets my attention. Eventually, that interest sort of waned for me. But just sort of as that interest was dying off, maybe I was finding other things that were related. I don't remember. But right around that same time, Sting released his solo album, Dream of the Blue Turtles. And Dream of the Blue Turtles was just this, again, it just felt like things meeting in a different way, this compelling blend of world music and, in that particular case, of world-class jazz musicianship. And basically, I was back on board. That album contained the song Russians. Now, even if you were never a follower of Sting or you're just, you know, too young to remember any of this in a personal way, you might have heard that particular song played recently, because it's been getting some airplay again after all these years. Sting had sort of mothballed it as being a piece that was very much of its time, very much a Cold War kind of piece of art. And then the war in the Ukraine cranked up, and the song just sort of, I think, all on its own started trending again. And Sting released a solo acoustic version of it to his Instagram account. The story of that song's origins back in 1985 is an interesting one, not least of all in the context of its resurgence. Here's what Sting says about the origins of that original version. Quote, in this political climate, so height of the Cold War, in this political climate, a friend of mine who was doing research at Columbia University in New York had a computer system sophisticated enough to intercept the Soviets' TV signal from their satellite above the North Pole. On a Saturday night in New York City, and another interview he talks about, we down two or three beers and climb this narrow staircase to an attic. He adds a little more environment, but in this quote, he just tells it this way. On a Saturday night in New York City, we could watch Sunday morning programs for the kids in Russia. The shows seemed thoughtful and sweet, and I suddenly felt the need to state something obvious in the face of all this rhetoric. Russians love their children just as we do. So he borrowed a melody from the Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev and wrote these lyrics. In Europe and America, there's a growing feeling of hysteria, conditioned to respond to all the threats and the rhetorical speeches of the Soviets. Mr. Khrushchev said, "We will bury you." I don't subscribe to this point of view. It'd be such an ignorant thing to do if the Russians love their children too. How can I save my little boy from Oppenheimer's deadly toy? There is no monopoly on common sense on either side of the political fence. We share the same biology regardless of ideology. Believe me when I say to you, I hope the Russians love their children too. There is no historical precedent to put the words in the mouth of the president. There's no such thing as a winnable war. It's a lie we don't believe anymore. Mr. Reagan says we will protect you. I don't subscribe to this point of view. Believe me when I say to you, I hope the Russians love their children too. We share the same biology, regardless of ideology, but what might save us, me and you, is if the Russians love their children too. It's a point of view that wasn't getting a lot of airtime at that moment in history, an unpopular and to some people indefensible posture in a Cold War environment, rife as it was with the categorical condemnation of not only a particular leadership regime, but of a whole people, culture, and part of the world. Stuart Copeland, the drummer of The Police, Sting's original band, had grown up with a dad that was a CIA operative, and he, for instance, had a very different stance on the issues. However, as he put it in a separate interview, a lyric like, "I hope the Russians love their children too," is indefensible, which is what I mean by needing the poets to bring things back into view. In his Instagram post of the new recording, the one that he just did within the last few months, Sting put it this way. He says, I've only rarely sung this song in the many years since it was written because I never thought it would be relevant again. But in the light of one man's bloody and woefully misguided decision to invade a peaceful, unthreatening neighbor, the song is, once again, a plea for our common humanity. For the brave Ukrainians fighting against this brutal tyranny, and also the many Russians who are protesting this outrage despite the threat of arrest and imprisonment, we, all of us, love our children. Stop the war. And then he offers the song. I've been pondering this idea, and I've been discussing it sort of casually with a variety of folks. If we, all of us, love our children, why would we do something as discernibly ridiculous as go to war with one another? We all know that when there's upheaval and suffering and deprivation, it's the kids that suffer the worst and the longest. We know that when we traumatize one young person, we're setting in motion generations of trauma. If we're smart enough to know that, why don't we seem to have whatever it is that would help us say not only stop the war, but let's not start the war? Well, I grew up around a religious narrative that liked to shortcut this question about what is it that seems to be wrong with us? Why can't we do this? It liked to shortcut that question by rolling out theology about fallenness and sinful nature and some of those ideas, some variations on those themes, which is both super tidy and not an adequate explanation of the equally baffling outrageous goodness and beauty that we also see human beings exhibit. It works great if you're selling salvation, but not so well outside of that. Now, maybe if we stay at least adjacent to our image of baby in bathwater for a few moments, we could think of the baby as the human. So far, not a reach. And the bathwater as whatever surrounds the human. Things like culture, ideology, systems of belief, historical narratives of entitlement, the stuff we make, but not us. And if we think of it that way, and then we factor in an idea like what we love, we care for, doesn't it seem a bit absurd that we would privilege the bathwater over the baby? Or even that we would treat them like equals? Because at least within a metaphor like this one, that's what we're doing if we dismiss, degrade, denigrate, destroy someone along with their ideas, traditions, culture, ideology, and so on. When we get confused about what's the baby and what's the bathwater, it's easier to throw one out along with the other. I find it interesting to think about the ways this intersection shows up in the religious stories that I grew up with. In the Hebrew stories, there's this repeated theme of if you have something good, as an individual or as a collective, it's a trust that you were given so that you can share it with those in need. And a subtext to that often in those Hebrew stories is you must share it with them without obliging them to become like you. If you have shelter and they need shelter, you offer shelter, and it's not a bait and switch. It's not you can come over here, but you have to convert. In other words, the stuff we make or the stuff we have, and in stuff I'm including ideas, exists to provide care for humans. The bathwater is there to clean up the babies. That makes it important, but not equal to them. When we start to value stuff, when we start to value what we make over people, whether that's on a personal, local, national, or global scale, we are overvaluing the bathwater and the baby is in danger. In the Second Testament, particularly in the teachings of Jesus, I've always been impressed by the lengths that Jesus goes to in making the point that all humans have value. Even in the context of Jesus' culture, people from categorically despised groups outside the tribe as well as marginalized groups from within it. So people like, broadly speaking, in the better known stories, people like Samaritans or women or children. And as we have the story, when people are in the early days making the religion we now think of as Christianity, and they're making that religion out of what they've heard Jesus teach and how they've seen Jesus live, one of the first big hurdles is sorting out that those teachings mean that if there's something good in there, in those teachings, it is meant to be good for all people, not just the people Jesus is identified with culturally or the people that identify with him, but all people. I think that this is still, for me, one of the most remarkable features of the history of Christianity, how early in its evolution this intersection shows up and how clearly the early stories point toward its resolution internally in that community that's making this nascent religion. Good news, they resolve, is for everyone. If you want it in the language of the text, it's for the Jews, the originating group, and the Gentiles, which is Jewish language for everybody else. When it ceases to be for everyone, it ceases to be good. And again, it's easy to lose sight of this. It's goodness ekes out of it when its value gets confused with the value of everyone. So we can take that, if it's not for everyone, it's losing its goodness idea, and we think, well, that's because not everyone has come over to that idea. Not the way it works. It stands on that Hebrew idea that this is a thing you offer. You offer it by how you enact your life. Not so that this other person will become like you, but because you believe that if you have something good, it's meant to be good for everyone. Or at least to be offered as goodness to everyone. Here's a sadness that's woven into that for me. The sadness is that both the early records and the lived experiences all down the line also show how quickly we forget this, and how easily we regress into confusing the relative value of differing ideas with the value of those holding the ideas. Maybe that British comedian was onto something. If we get this confused in ways that muddy the water enough, we can lose sight of the fact that there's a baby in there. And in the process of thinking critically, even dismissively, about the gray, tepid mess that our notions can become, perhaps arriving at the point where we feel they need to be discarded, we can endanger what is of much greater value. If we're not careful, we can end up throwing the babies out with the bathwater. I'm going to leave us with one last thought, and I find this one personally especially challenging. I sure don't feel like this is an idea I have sorted. I think I could say that about almost everything I say at the table, that this is about a very dynamic, fluid process, that the exploration of what we believe, not about saying, and here's a new idea that we should all adopt. I find this one especially challenging, and it keeps coming back to sort of niggle at me. I think that maybe Sting is only part of the way there when he says that the key to stopping wars, or at least to keeping them from expanding into the utterly indiscriminate realm of what we call mass destruction, is to remember that we love our children. I think that's partway there. That is a beautiful, powerful, I would say for the most part, graspable idea. But it does still seem like it leaves the door open for something like, I love my children more than I love your children. So if you threaten mine, I'm coming after you. And in that process, somehow, I'm going to find a way to tuck out of sight the fact that when I hurt you, when I hurt you, I hurt your kids. And when I hurt your kids, I put my kids in danger. That's that interconnection that we've been bumping up against so often this last while in the talkie bits. The interconnectedness of everything and everyone, that we actually do belong to one another and aren't just sort of in some vague ethical or moral way responsible for one another's well-being, but materially responsible for one another's well-being as well. This call to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, it starts local, but it doesn't stay there. That's the kind of idea that is unruly and expansive in ways that only something like love can be. It's an idea that's not just big enough to keep us from throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but to call us to find ways to not throw out the babies with the bathwater. Not just yours and mine, but all of them. That's where I'm going to leave it for today. I don't know about you. I feel like I've got plenty to work on there. And we'll just carry that into our week and keep setting it up against everyday experiences, everyday thoughts, everyday measurings of the things we hear and of the inputs we receive and the perspectives. Good to be with you. Thank you for the time together. Peace to you all. Bye for now.